Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from vanadium to violins. Appropriately in this week's show, we're talking about sound. We'll revisit an explosive urban legend and visit two musicians who rely on unique materials to create their instruments. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. Sound is an integral part of our interaction with the environment, and hearing is one of the five senses we rely on most to negotiate the world. At its most primal level, sound is part of the survival instinct, alerting us to flee from danger. It offers an evolutionary boost by giving us the power of communication through speech, and it brings some of our greatest cultural pleasures in music and, of course, podcasting. At the scientific level, sounds are just waves. And what we hear is determined by the frequency, direction, and volume of these vibrations as they bounce off the materials around us. Naturally, if you're talking about materials, you're talking about chemistry. CHF's Chi Chan introduces us to an important chemical sound source in today's Element of the Week.
With an atomic number of 60, neodymium is classified as a rare earth element, although it's hardly rare. It's actually the 28th most abundant element in the Earth's crust, coming in slightly behind more commonly known elements like copper and zinc. When neodymium is alloyed with iron and boron, it becomes a ferromagnetic material, forming a permanent and powerful magnet. The most common combination of these metals is referred to as a neodymium magnet or rare earth magnet. Neodymium magnets are lightweight and relatively cheap to produce because of the element's abundance. In fact, they've largely replaced more expensive magnets made from samarium and cobalt. Neodymium is used in a wide variety of practical applications, from lasers to light filtering glass, while neodymium magnets are used in the head motor compartment of computer hard drives. But one particularly useful application of the magnets is in audio speakers. The most common speakers, the one we see at clubs and in our home stereos, are based on drivers that rely on electricity and magnetism to produce sound. Each driver has a fixed magnetic base and a frame with a diaphragm attached to a voice coil. The coil is usually copper or aluminum, which becomes electromagnetic when passed through an electrical charge. The proximity of the magnetic fields of the voice coil and neodymium magnet will make the coil oscillate back and forth, causing the attached diaphragm to move and produce sound waves. So all that heavy metal you're hearing from your neighbor's basement? It's not just heavy metal, it's a rare earth metal. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Chi Chan.
Chi Chan is Program Coordinator for Innovation at CHF's Center for Contemporary History and Policy. You may have heard the urban legend about the original Coca-Cola containing some amount of cocaine. That one is true. But another fizzy urban legend is a little harder to pin down. It's about Pop Rocks, the sizzling, fizzing candy that used to be marketed under the slogan, "Taste the Explosion." Only half the fun of Pop Rocks came from their tantalizing sense of danger. If they didn't make such wonderful sounds, would anyone eat them? Jennifer Dionisio explains in today's Chemistry in Your Cupboard.
Pop Rocks were invented in 1956 and introduced to market in 1975 by William A. Mitchell, a food chemist at General Foods. A master of novelty snacks, Mitchell also invented Tang, Kwikset Jell-O, Cool Whip, and powdered egg whites. Pop Rocks are made by subjecting the sugary candy to high-pressure carbon dioxide gas while still in liquid form. As the candy cools off and solidifies, microscopic bubbles of CO2 are formed throughout. In fact, if you look at the candy with a magnifying glass, you can actually see the bubbles of trapped gas. When you eat Pop Rocks, the moisture in your mouth melts the candy and releases the carbon dioxide, creating its signature pop and sizzle. The well-circulated urban legend says that if you eat Pop Rocks and drink carbonated soda at the same time, so much gas will be released that your stomach will explode. Remember Mikey, the kid from the Life cereal commercials? He supposedly died this way. Like most urban legends, this isn't true, but reality didn't stop an onslaught of parental concern. The FDA even set up a hotline to announce the candy's harmlessness. General Foods tried to fight back by taking out full-page advertisements in over 45 major publications and sending Mitchell all over the country to demonstrate the candy's safety. General Foods stopped selling the candy in 1983, which further fueled the urban legend. Today, Pop Rocks are manufactured and sold by Zeta Espacial S.A., a candy company in Spain. Incidentally, Mitchell was actually trying to create instant soda when he stumbled upon this explosively sweet invention. And that's today's Chemistry in Your Cupboard. I'm Jennifer Dionisio.
Jennifer Dionisio is Program Coordinator for Biotechnology at the Chemical Heritage Foundation's Center for Contemporary History and Policy. Got something to say about what you've heard on today's show? Send your comments to distillations@chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Finally today, below the surface of most works of art are the raw materials: paint, canvas, plastic, metal, wood. Artists have their own reasons for choosing materials, some practical, some aesthetic, some quirky and personal. Producer Catherine Girardot visited two musical instrument builders, one who combines mostly ordinary objects to create otherworldly music, and one who makes extraordinary sculptures that can also be played.
My name is Oliver DiCicco. I'm an instrument builder, sculptor, designer.
I'm Bart Hopkin. I'm the guy that runs something called Experimental Musical Instruments. People all over the place making all kinds of interesting things with which to make music.
I visited these two experimental instrument builders in their workshops. I wanted to see and hear how they chose the building blocks of their sonic art. I asked Bart Hopkin what he looks for in choosing materials to build musical instruments.
There's a certain amount of mythology or fairy tale about this when people talk about Stradivarius and his famous varnishes and this kind of stuff. And there's undoubtedly some truth to that, but a lot of it is more romantic than scientific. Most musical instruments begin with an initial vibrating body of some sort, and somehow that pattern of oscillation has to get into the air and get into people's ears.
It doesn't matter if he's talking about a Stradivarius or styrofoam. When he's going to make an instrument, Hopkins sees stuff, mainly as it relates to how it will produce sound. Like this styrofoam cooler strung with rubber bands, this humble instrument embodies many of the sound-making properties Hopkin has been explaining. Hopkin talks about some of the qualities that make different materials produce sound differently.
A very, very important feature of different sounding materials is internal damping. How readily do waves propagate in the material as opposed to dissipating themselves mostly into heat? Things that do not have a lot of internal damping will sustain vibrations much longer. Damping effects usually affect high frequencies, so that materials that have very little internal damping tend to have much brighter sounds associated with more high frequencies present. Here's an example, the difference between a nylon string guitar and a steel string guitar. You know, the steel string guitar has these ringing tones. The nylon string guitar is more warm and woody. A lot of that is simply because the nylon strings themselves have greater internal damping than the very, very hard steels that are used in steel strings nowadays.
When Bart Hopkin looks at stuff for building instruments, he's looking mainly for how well it's going to work acoustically. Designer and musical sculptor Oliver DiCicco, on the other hand, is just as concerned with how his raw materials look as he is with how they'll sound.
Some of it has to do with the tools that I have and the capacity I have to work with certain materials, and that dictates a lot of how things look.
Although they spend a lot of time crafting and wrestling with materials, both DiCicco and Hopkin have made instruments that incorporate water, an unpredictable element that can't be shaped, sanded, or fixed. Hopkin shows me his vaguely lute-shaped instrument, played on the lap, made out of a steel mixing bowl,
with some rigid brazing rods brazed onto it, which are played with a bow. The vibration is transmitted to the body of this vessel.
The bottom of the bowl, which contains water, acts like a diaphragm, a surface that vibrates in response to sound. This is DiCicco's most recent water sculpture, Sirens. It's basically 11 U-shaped arcs with tubes inside and penny whistles at the ends of the tubes. Motors rock the arcs back and forth, moving the water, which pushes air out of the tubes through the penny whistles.
The test piece sounded like whales. So I thought, well, maybe I'll make it look like the ribs of a whale, because they're going to be these U-shaped pieces out of plywood. The movement is totally random. It's like the sea, ebb and flow and in and out of phase.
For Distillations, I'm Catherine Girardeau in San Francisco.
Catherine Girardeau of Earprint Productions is a San Francisco-based writer, producer, and digital storyteller. The music you hear is entitled Baby Please Don't Go by Bart Hopkin, played on the instrument Savart's Wheel, a motorized tuned rasp. You can find links to the musicians featured in this story on our website, distillations.chemheritage.org. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from famed pianist Ludwig van Beethoven. Moods are translated by the poet into words, by me into tones that sound and roar and storm about me until I have set them down in notes. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.